Welcome to Resilience in the Shadows, the podcast by Tent Makers. I'm your host, Alex Payton, and I'm joined by my co-host, Letitia Payton, the executive director and co-founder of Tent Makers of Louisiana. Today, we have the privilege of welcoming our special guest, Faith Hakesley. Faith is a wife, homeschooling mother, blogger, and author who has overcome tremendous challenges in her life. Born and raised in Massachusetts, she holds a bachelor's degree in criminal justice from the University of Massachusetts, Lowell. Faith's story is one of resilience and triumph over numerous traumas, including surviving rape by a Catholic priest, coping with the death of a brother, battling incurable cancer, and facing a serious heart condition that nearly took her life. In 2008, Faith was one of five victims of clerical abuse from the Archdiocese of Boston, who had a private meeting with Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI during his trip to Washington, D.C. This encounter fueled her passion for using her story as a source of hope and healing for others. Faith has shared her inspiring story on various platforms, including CNN, Face the Nation, and Catholic Connection with Teresa Tamio. She has also been a guest speaker at events like the 2009 Women Affirming Life Breakfast in Norwood, Massachusetts, and has contributed as a writer for the National Catholic Register. In August 2020, Faith published her first book, Glimmers of Grace, Moments of Peace and Healing Following Sexual Abuse, a devotional for victims of sexual abuse, published by Our Sunday Visitor. You can explore more of her insights on her blog, Faith Restored, which is available on faithhakesley.com. In addition to her impactful advocacy work, Faith is the Vice President of the Tent Makers of Louisiana Board, contributing her leadership to the organization's mission. Join us in this insightful conversation as we navigate through the shadows with Faith Hakesley, exploring resilience, finding hope, and building strength in the face of adversity. Faith, welcome to Resilience in the Shadows. We are honored to have you as a guest.
Thank you so much for having me.
Faith, let's begin with a recap of your story. Can you please just share briefly what happened to you so that our listeners who are unfamiliar with your story will get an understanding before we move into other issues associated with clerical sexual abuse?
Sure. So I was raised in a very devout Catholic home. I was one of four children. It was myself and three brothers. And we spent a lot of time around our parish community and, you know, just being the faithful Catholics that we were there a lot. And when I was 15 years old, an elderly woman who was working at the rectory at the time offered me a job working at the rectory on Saturdays. It was promised to be light work. I wouldn't be dealing with a whole lot of people because Saturdays were usually quiet. And I was told that I could do my schoolwork and things, you know, there when things got quiet. So I was excited about it. It was my first job, my first, you know, paid job. My parents were excited about it. Because they just thought I would be in a safe environment with, you know, wonderfully safe and holy environment. But unfortunately, that was not what it turned out to be. So after I started this job, I quickly realized that it was not safe, nor the people working there very holy. Unfortunately, I got to know one of the priests in ways that I never thought I would get to know a priest. He was newly ordained. He came from Colombia, and this was his first assignment. And in hindsight, I realized that he was grooming me. He took advantage of the fact that I was alone on those Saturdays, and for several months, I suffered sexual abuse. He was eventually transferred, but even before he was transferred, he still was able to get to me on several occasions. What happened was, after a few months, I had had enough, and I couldn't deal with this anymore. My parents were starting to realize that something was really off with me. My grades in school were really suffering, and I just couldn't explain it away anymore. And I used the excuse of the job. I said, oh, well, it's just taking so much time away from my schoolwork. I'm just not able to focus on school. So that was my excuse for being able to quit the job. But even after I quit, he asked me for violin lessons. it's funny in a way how, and I don't mean ha-ha kind of funny, but it's interesting how predators are able to kind of get their claws into just about every part of their victims' lives. And violin was something that I had been passionate about. It was one of my talents. And he apparently had always wanted to learn the violin. And so after I quit, he asked my parents and me if I would be willing to give him some violin lessons. What could I say? It would have looked bad if I said, no, I'm not going to give him not going to give you violin lessons. So even after I had quit, he still found ways to get to me. He still found ways to kind of take over the areas of my life that I loved. About a year later, after the abuse first began, my oldest brother, Matt, passed away very suddenly. It turned out he had a heart condition that we weren't aware of. But it was because of Matt's death and the trauma of finding him, and just, I mean, that's a tough thing, grieving the loss of your brother. Because of that, my parents recognized that I was just not, something was really off with me that extended beyond the grief of losing Matt. And so they put me into grief therapy with a trusted counselor. And it was then that I was able to come forward to her and tell her the things that had happened. And a short time later, I was able to tell my parents, get them on board, you know, and they were nothing but supportive from the very beginning. And thankfully from there, I was able to embark on the very difficult but very long journey towards healing. A few years later, I was given the opportunity to press charges. I was asked if I wanted to face him in court. When I heard that he had had other female victims, I did choose to confront him in court. I was the only minor that we knew of at the time. All the other females were adults. So from a legal perspective, there wasn't, for most of his victims, there wasn't anything illegal that had happened necessarily. There was one other woman who was going to press rape charges against him, but she backed out for personal reasons. So in the end, he was, I faced him in court, very painful, but he was eventually sentenced to prison. He completed his sentence, I think it was in 2013, and then was deported. And as you read in my introduction in 2008, I was given the opportunity to meet with Pope Benedict and some other survivors from the Archdiocese of Boston. And it was that meeting that really set me on my journey to towards greater healing, and also towards wanting to help other survivors through the trauma of clerical abuse in particular.
Faith, you had mentioned after grief therapy, you were able to speak about what happened. When you spoke to your parents, what was their initial reaction when you told them?
I actually want to cry thinking about it, because they both burst into tears. My mom just grabbed me and held me. And my dad's, through his tears, and I mean, you could tell they were just in shock, but the first question he asked was, who did it? Kind of you know, being married now and, you know, being around, you know, my husband and having our own children, it's just seems like such a dad-like response. He wanted to know who hurt my little girl. And they just held me and they just cried. And in a way, As horrified as they were about what had happened to me, they were relieved too, because finally they knew what was wrong with their daughter. They were just at their wit's end trying to figure out how they could help me, and now they knew.
So initially when you told your parents, you didn't say, "Father, so-and-so sexually assaulted me or raped me." It was that you had been raped?
I don't remember exactly what words I used, just that I had been hurt by a priest.
Oh, okay.
And so I didn't use his name initially, but then once my dad asked, I told them. And they said, you know, it makes sense. It makes sense, because he was the one that had the most access to me. And then after that, my parents were able to, because they had questions of their own. You know, the grooming process, which I know you've discussed with other guests in the past, is something that is such a mystery to a lot of people. And it's something that we're kind of only it's still kind of a new thing for people. A lot of people still don't know about the grooming process. So for my parents, even they were trying to figure out, how did this happen? They had always taught us, if something bad happens, someone touches you, they say something, you come to us, you can trust us, we'll believe you. So I think as a parent, it was hard for them to wrap their brains around this. So they went to therapy themselves. They got the help they needed to deal with what I was, so they could help me and also work through the emotions themselves, but also to learn more about sexual abuse and the grooming process and everything that goes along with that, which was very helpful to them, so that, again, they could help me better understand me. Also, so they also got help themselves, so they weren't asking me the questions that they needed answered. They could ask, a professional who knew what she was talking about, who could comfortably answer whatever questions they had.
And I think too, for our Catholic listeners and even some of our non-Catholic listeners too, something that we that keeps coming up in a lot of these cases, and definitely with ours as well, and you heard it, Faith had said that one of the reasons why they were excited, her parents were excited about her taking the job at the church parish, was because it was a safe environment. And so as Catholics, there's the assumption that working at a church parish, being around the clergy, is going to be safe. And so I think that's part of the, it's what makes the grooming process, I think, easier, is because we're already biased going into it, right? We're already assuming that you're going into a safe environment when you're at a church, when you're with the priest. And I'm sure in other denominations, it's like that too. Pastor Jim is Pastor Jim, but I think that's when looking at a lot of these, that's just a common thread, is that we all went in with the assumption of safety, even when we probably wouldn't have gone in with that assumption if it wasn't a Catholic priest or at our church, right? I mean, we typically don't immediately assume the best intentions of a stranger, but when it's a priest, we kind of let our guard down because it's our faith. It's the church, right? So I think that's a very important point that we see, coming up, that repeatedly comes up in these cases, and definitely, like I said, with ours. Because Faith, I don't know if you know this, but Oliver and I worked at the church parish. That's what we did, doing odd jobs and the sort. And we were alone as well. It was just me, him, and Father. And so, there's this assumption. I mean, Oliver and I definitely had this assumption of safety because we were at the church with the priest, and I think Mom has a good point to bring up about that as well.
I know, Faith, I don't know exactly how old you are. I can't remember, and you don't even have to say it. But my point is, with safe environment, was safe environment actually a thing at the time when you were 15? Was that something that everybody had to be trained in? Do you remember?
No. See, I'm 39 now.
Okay.
So this was actually, my case went public right around the time that, it was in 2002, right around the same time that the spotlight, that case broke out of Boston. Now, my case ended up getting a lot more attention than they expected because of the timing. But they weren't expecting spotlight, the attorney didn't know that was going on. So when they went public with my case, it kind of exploded because they realized, this is still going on. This isn't a thing of the past. So all of those safety type things started to go in after the fact.
And I know now that you bring that up, that's actually it that might change how I guess the community reacted, since it was so public and at the forefront at the time. But when everything went public, what was the reaction that you and your family got from the community, the local community? Was it supportive? Was it abrasive? How did they react?
It was definitely a mix. We had some support. However, I was absolutely floored when even people who I had known my whole life, because this was a parish I had grown up in, people who turned against me financially and in any other way supported my rapist. Actually, there was at the time, he was he was starting up, as I think I mentioned, he was from Colombia. So he was starting a small Spanish community at the church. They all supported him. And I remember one Sunday, my parents tried to hide this from me. I was angry at them at the time. And now in hindsight, I understand they were just trying to give me as normal an experience, you know, a life as possible. They did what they thought they had to do to protect me. But there was one Sunday after Mass where people stood outside giving out pamphlets with his picture on it, you know, save Kelvin, help him with his expenses, you know, this horrible person has made accusations against him that aren't true. We all know they aren't true. I mean, it was awful. I just happened to find this pamphlet. And there, again, there were people who had been, I thought were people who I looked up to for years, who just totally, they went and supported him, which was really hard because you've been not only betrayed by this man of God, you're now betrayed by your spiritual, you know, your brothers and sisters in Christ, your church family. So, but then there were people who did support us. It were people who came, you know, to me privately and said, oh, you know, a long time ago, I was abused by a relative and, you know, things like that. People who tried to, who really did try to make me feel better because of the issues that we were having at the parish. We did kind of start to go to a different Catholic church in town for a while because it was just too painful. It was painful enough for me just to step into any Catholic church, but 100 times more painful to step into that church, to see the rectory, you know, to even forget about me even going into the confessional, like none of that. So we did for a time start going to a different parish because of the backlash we faced.
So in court, did the priest, what was his name, Father, did you say Kelvin?
Kelvin Iguabita Rodriguez.
Okay, so Father Kelvin Rodriguez. Mm-hmm. What about the other two victims? You said there were two other victims or three that were women that were grown, so over the age of 18, I should say, adult women?
There were several. There were actually several. One testified in my behalf. This priest was in his 30s. This was a woman in her 60s, a former nun. She went to him for spiritual counseling, and he clearly, you know, he took advantage of her. And when she found out that when he left our church, when he was being transferred, he was supposed to be transferred to the marriage tribunal in Boston. So he was going to be working with married couples who were having issues. So this woman heard that, and she was initially the one who kind of blew the whistle on him, and that's why when he was removed was because of what she said. But he hadn't done anything illegal, technically, and it was nothing illegal. So when I came forward, I remember meeting with someone from the Archdiocese, and he said, this is what he didn't say it in a gleeful way, but he was saying, you know, this is what we were waiting for. We were waiting for the other shoe to drop because we knew there was just more to this. They were just kind of waiting for, you know, something illegal. And I was the minor in the case. So she did testify in my behalf. There was, there was another female victim who testified. And then, other women have come to me over the years telling me, yes, he did this to me also. They've just chosen not to go public. I'd say at least 10 that I know of personally.
That's
so
just,
who knows?
That's just incredible. And the only, it sounds like the only reason that he could not be prosecuted for their crimes was because they were adult women. They suffered some sort of rape or unwanted touches or whatever the case may be, but because they were adult women, they had no case. That's just unbelievable to me.
There was one woman who was going to press charges, and that trial was supposed to be started. It was supposed to start right after mine ended. However, for personal reasons, she chose to back out. It almost seems like the cases, she was a violent case of rape. It seems like when there is grooming involved and the rape is less violent, according to, you know, the authorities, I guess, I think then it becomes, well, was this consensual? We know it's not actually consensual, but from a legal standpoint, it is difficult to prosecute when, I think, when there is grooming involved. It makes it more difficult because then it almost in some cases makes it look, especially when the victim was an adult, it almost makes it look like she went along with it.
Right. And the whole grooming process is what throws it off for adult women. And I really guess I hadn't really thought too much about this considering, you know, I know that there are women, adult women, who have been raped by their priest. I have spoken with many of them who did not come forward for different reasons. But it never occurred to me just how, I'm not even sure the words that the right words to use here, that just because they were adults and not minors, someone may not listen to them, that it would just automatically be consensual.
It's almost as if I've known other victims who have experienced this as well, where it's almost like the rape wasn't serious enough. I have a friend who was raped and the police basically told her, well, we don't really see this as a rape because she didn't try, you know, she didn't try to get away. She was, you know, she experienced that freezing type response that so many victims get. I froze. It was like, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? You literally feel like you can't move. You're in such shock. But yeah, and she and I were talking about this one time and she said, I guess I would have been, I guess they would have maybe had a case if he had murdered me. So it's like, I guess it wasn't serious enough.
Well, and this brings up something that that I've seen recently. So of course, a lot of cases of clerical sexual abuse deal with minor boys. And so that's kind of at the forefront. And so on things like Catholic Twitter, where of course it sounds silly, but this is where a lot of discussion and culture happens. You know, when those cases are discussed, of course it's discussed very timidly because it's difficult to try to navigate. But I've noticed that when it is women, especially when they're not, you know, 5 years old or something, right? When they're at that 15, 16, the responses are very strange. And it's because they're immediately, and we already touched on this, but I just wanted to bring it up again. But there's immediately an effort to try to discredit the victim right out the gate. And typically it revolves around like what you had said about, well, I mean, how do you know that it wasn't consensual? I mean, she might have liked this priest, yada, yada, yada. And we recently had something like that in the Diocese of Lafayette, a priest who had involved himself with a woman, and the woman ended up making the complaint, and it became a boundary violation. And then it became, you know, people talking about, well, I mean, how do you not know that the woman didn't want to, you know, you don't know. So what is your experience been like in the advocacy world? What has your experience been like being a woman victim? Do you find that people typically react to you a little differently than, you know, minor boys? Like what's the experience like being a woman in that environment and your treatment from not just other people, other Catholics, other community people, but also the hierarchy, priests, bishops? Do they respond differently than you've seen them respond to other cases with other victims that aren't women?
Well, obviously I can't speak for, you know, any male survivors of abuse, but I have dealt with, you know, people from all sides. Yeah. And I would say that the response is, it varies. Personally, I have been fairly well supported by our Cardinal Sean O'Malley, bishops who I'm friendly with, priests who I'm friendly with. By and large, they have been very supportive of me. However, I mean, in the online world, wow, sometimes there are days when I look at my husband and I say, this is not worth it. It's not, you know, and I just cry. Twitter, especially. My goodness, I wonder, where do these people come from? And do they have nothing else better to do with their time? It is astounding, some of the responses I have gotten. And again, I don't know if males experience the same kind of response, but I had one guy tell me just the other day, he said that the reason, in his humble opinion, the reason I experienced what I experienced was I wasn't aware of my own sexuality, my own borders, and I didn't have knowledge of sexual violations that occur in every society. I wasn't quite sure. Clearly, people don't understand the grooming process. I've also had other survivors tell me things such as, well, my mom taught me to, you know, kick him in the groin. That worked for me. So why didn't you do that? Or then there's the whole, why is it so hard to be Catholic? We're here for Jesus. So if you can't put him first, then what's wrong with you? And then I've had other people who are just incredibly compassionate and loving and supportive. But believe me, I don't do what I do for the response from other people. Like I said, it wouldn't be worth it. But yeah, there are, it varies.
You know,
it
what varies. What I find astounding, and this is what I always, this is what always kind of gets me. The chance that any of these people responding know this Father Kelvin, the chance that any of them ever knew him is probably zero, right? And so it's astounding to me, because typically outside of church sexual abuse, typically you don't really find many people taking the side of the perpetrator who they do not know. Whether that's good or bad, they're typically always siding with the accuser, especially now, I mean, this was, you know, your case was before the Me Too movement, but I mean, especially even after, you know, Me Too, the typical response is always kind of is victim centric. Like you see it with Hollywood stuff and other things. It's typically always that, even sometimes when you know the story doesn't kind of make sense, and I think it is safe to always be victim-centric anyway, but I mean, even when the story is kind of outrageous, there's always that immediate, we're going to side with the victim until we know for a fact that he or she is not the victim. But in the church, amongst lay people, and sometimes even hierarchy too, it's so weird that their immediate defense is of the perpetrator when they do not know him, which means they have no respect for him, quote unquote, right? They don't know him enough. So I find that so odd that random strangers would be willing to side with the perpetrator they don't know instead of the survivor. Like that's something that I think is so specific to clergy sexual abuse. And I think, which of course you can correct me or add any thoughts, my reasoning here is that I think what they're really doing is defending perceived threats to the church that you are presenting them, because you're not attacking your perpetrator. You're attacking, in quotes, the church. So I think that's where it comes from, but that's so dangerous. I think even with a Catholic theology too, because then that means that faith's not attacking just some institution. She's attacking the church established by Jesus Christ, the bride of Christ, you know, the one true church, right? And so that's so dangerous, because that leads to, it's so easy to dehumanize someone when they become not just an enemy of me, but an enemy of Christ himself. So I think that's where it comes from.
You're absolutely right. That hits the nail on the head, because I feel the same way. And you know, sometimes it's humbling to be a survivor, especially if you've, you know, put yourself forward in any kind of public way. It is very humbling, because you are going to get attacked from all sides, and you are going to get those people who, I think they want, on the one hand, I see they love Holy Mother Church so much that they want to defend it at all costs, but they have to keep in mind that we are talking about the people part of the church, not the spiritual part of the church, because there's nothing wrong with the spiritual part of the church, you know, that the part that Jesus left, that Jesus left us. It is the human part that is severely, severely flawed. And if you truly love the church and you truly love Jesus and believe that this is the church he left us, then you will do what you can to get rid of the bad stuff and the bad people. But people don't see it that way. They see someone like me or you that come along, and they immediately think, oh, they're trying to bring down the church. No, I'm not. I'm trying to help it. I'm trying to bring out this filth. Let's bring it out into the, you know, and let's help our church to do better. Let's help the people part to do better. So I think, you know, pride is the root of all evil. And I see so much pride at the center of clerical abuse, even among other Catholics and even very faithful, very devout Catholics who I've dealt with. They are so full of pride that they don't want to admit that this people part of the church, this human part, it's not perfect. And they want to be able to look at any priest, just how I grew up. I grew up looking at priests as just these sort of divine persons. And in my mind, I knew so many wonderful priests growing up. You know, one in particular who we're still in contact with, I used to sit on his lap when I was a little kid, and we'd pray the rosary, and there was nothing wrong, nothing, you know, weird going on there. I've been blessed to have so many wonderful relationship with priests over the years. So to have a priest behave in this manner was just so unexpected. And I know that's the case for many Catholics. And it's humbling to admit that you were wrong about someone. Oh, I really liked this priest. And then you find out, oh, he wasn't so great. So we attack the victim instead of the perpetrator. And it happens all the time. It's, like I said, it's very humbling to be a victim, because on the one hand you think, well, maybe people will believe me, but it's, you know, we're all Catholic, right? We all have the same beliefs, and, you know, we're all passionate about our faith. And then you realize, oh no, there's a lot of pride out there.
And Faith, one thing, going back to the grooming process, when he was doing this to you, was he using your faith against you as he was attacking you? I hear from a lot of victims where, you know, the priest would, if it was in spiritual direction, like women who had trouble in marriage and their priest was directing them with marriage problems, and then some abuse happened. Generally, they would use God as, you know, the excuse that God is calling me. I need to help you with this. We need to work through this. And, you know, they were literally using their faith against them, or condemning them. God will send you to hell if you don't participate in what I want you to do with me, or something like that. Was he using any of that with you?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And actually, it came up for me recently because of this book, and I won't get into it too much, but this book that we found out about regarding, written by Cardinal Fernandez, who's the head of the DDF. I read a little bit of this Mystical Passion book, and it was very triggering, not just because it was, parts of it were graphic, but because some of the things that were written, really, it reminded me of some of the things my perpetrator had said to me. And I mean, I talked about this actually online, and some of the responses I got were interesting. But that's one of the concerns I have about this book, and that even though it has disappeared magically, as it has, it's disappeared. I'm not saying that this cardinal ever hurt anyone. I'm not saying he's an abuser, but some of the stuff in that book sounds an awful lot like spiritual and sexual grooming. So yes, my predator did use things, you know, I won't go into detail, but, you know, he did say things that, or he would pray with me about issues I was having at school. You know, he had become my confidant, because I was struggling in school. I was a 15-year-old girl. There were a lot of things going on, you know, and he would pray with me over a certain situation. And then he's going and do that. I remember him one time, he was telling me I needed to be careful. I wasn't dating. I wasn't allowed to date, but he told me one time, you know, you got to be really careful at your age. You got to be careful for, you know, you don't want to come down with any STDs. So be careful around boys. I'm like, what? And this was in the middle of him doing things to me. And then we're praying, and then we're, you know, he's praying with me about certain situations. You know, it's just, it's absolutely unreal. But yes, I know other survivors have experience the same thing. And then you're really conflicted because this person, again, represents God. And so they're manipulating every part of your being, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. They're manipulating you.
So I think it goes back to when, you know, people say, well, I'm teaching my daughter, you know, self-defense so that if one of these priests would do something to her, you know, she can fight, she can get away, but we're not even thinking about the mind games and the manipulation and the months of the grooming. Because I know, mm-hmm. like for in our case, with my son, people, you know, immediately following, people kept saying, well, we taught our kids how to fight and our kids know how to, you know, my sons would have done this and my sons would have done that. And I had to ask them, I said, well, what if your son was drunk and passed out or had been given some pills and could not defend himself? And the response was, oh, well, I hadn't thought of that. So I think, you know, parents need to, there's so much to the grooming process that I think parents don't understand, and they're so quick to judge. You know, in your case, in young women or adult women or young boys, yes, they may be able to fight off if someone was coming directly at them and attacking you, but we have to learn and educate people on this whole grooming process and the manipulation that goes with it.
And I think too...
My parents did, they got responses from other parents, such as what you just mentioned. They also, one of the big ones was, I remember someone saying to them, my daughter would have come to me because we talk about things. And my parents' response was, we talk about things too, but clearly, again, you don't understand the grooming process. Also, I remember I was beating myself up because I didn't fight back, because I would freeze when the attack started. And I remember the sexual assault detective telling me, you know, Faith, even if you had tried to fight back physically, he probably would have hurt you even more than he did. So, you know, I don't know.
And, you know, another important thing, and this is for the listeners, especially those who aren't familiar with this. Whenever people use the, well, my daughter, my son, or I would have defended, you're assuming that the attacker is someone on the street. You're walking and it's the scary boogeyman who comes out the alleyway and the, you know, and that's not the case. I guess another one would be, you know, I carry a gun with me when I go places. Where do I don't carry a gun? With my own family, right? With my own close friends. So if one of my family members or a close friend decided to start, I don't know, a rampage, I would be vulnerable. Because I never felt the need to have protection when I'm with my friends and family. So not only is a priest your quote-unquote friend, even if it's not really your friend, but just a friend, he's also a spiritual leader. So you've got the grooming process going on, and this is also someone who you go to for the sacraments, someone that the church says is able to act in persona Christi, in the person of Christ. So your guard, just by default, is typically down. So you're not even in that mode to prepare for self-defense. And that's why, too, another thing that Faith has said and that you hear a lot, it's always a shock when it occurs. And it's a shock because it's coming from someone it wasn't supposed to. It wasn't the boogeyman in the street. It wasn't the guy running out the alleyway, the homeless man, right? So I think that's important. And I think a lot of people not familiar don't understand, too, the power of grooming. But also, you're having grooming mixed in with spirituality. And Faith had mentioned the Cardinal's book, and I won't go into it as much either because you'd need a whole podcast segment just on that. But Faith had brought up the Cardinal's book. And a lot of reaction to the book is that it's not necessarily heretical. And if you read a lot of the older writings, you've got some kind of eroticism there. But that book is dangerous. And I think that if your priest is preaching on that book in any kind of positive way, you absolutely have to approach him. If you hear anyone, because there's a dangerous mix of eroticism and spirituality in that book. And it's funny that you bring that book up, because I was literally having a discussion with someone and they had mentioned, well, it doesn't seem heretical. And I went, I don't care. I'm not a heresy police here. I'm concerned about the logical conclusion of this stuff. So I think if you do know about the book, yeah, it is dangerous. I don't care about heresies, church teaching on sexuality, that doesn't matter. Just if this book is dangerous, and I think that you should definitely know about it so that you can figure out if it's being talked about or if it's being used. But I just wanted to make sure that that was made mention of, because I have read through it and it is not good. So
it was inspired by a 16-year-old girl, first of all. So
yes,
that alone, I mean, that is nothing short of creepy. That is beyond creepy. And what I read, and I wasn't able to read the whole thing, but the portions that I read, we're not talking about theology of the body or Saint, is it Hildebrand, Hildegard, what she wrote? Totally different. Different. There's no comparison. So yeah, it's a dangerous situation.
And I know there has to be a fine line between subjecting yourself to fear porn and just absolute darkness just for the sake of it. But I definitely think you know, to the listeners, you definitely, if you don't want to read it, I don't think you should, but I don't think you have to, I should say, then read some summary of it, and trust me, they'll capture the spirit. Just, I definitely think that our listeners need to know about it, just because there's actually, now once again on Twitter, which we don't know if that's even real life, but there's actually quite a bit of support amongst Catholics and priests, a surprising number of priests, for the book. And it's been turned into kind of a liberal Catholic versus conservative Catholic type thing. Ignore all that. It's bad. I don't care what you are. It's a bad book. So keep that in mind. Please be aware of what that is and its existence, just so that if it is talked about in any official way, I think that's one of those moments where you kind of have to, if you're able to, you probably should stand up and try to nip it in the bud immediately.
So Faith, one thing that is really bothering me a whole bunch as we are talking about your case with adult women, because I know there's a few cases all around the country. I've spoken with some a victim and a victim's friend in North Dakota about some things that are going on up there, spoken to people in other parts of the country, but in North Dakota, it's adult women and a priest. And it almost sounds like by ignoring this problem we have in the church with women, these priests can get a pass because adult women will be looked at as something consensual rather than the fact that they are truly being raped or put into positions. Well, no, there's no other way to call it. It's rape.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you go to someone with, I think what's happening in a lot of these cases, these are women who are going to a priest who is supposed to be a good, holy, spiritual advisor. And these priests are taking advantage of what these women are sharing with them. Gross advantage. And yeah, it all comes back to grooming, the grooming process. And it's really sad and quite frankly pathetic that even adult women and men, because I've seen this with adult men too, even seminarians who just aren't they're not being taken seriously for, you know, the things that have been done to them. It's like, let's point at the victims. Oh, you know, with females, especially the adults, you know, what was she wearing? She must have been in love with the priest. She's the one who's the problem. Like this priest is some sort of innocent victim. It's like people really need to wake up. They need to educate themselves and understand what's going on here. These are priests who are using calculated measures to systematically groom and abuse their victims.
And Faith, moving on to the last part of our interview here, if you were to address some listeners, our audience is, of course, going to be some people who are very familiar, maybe not intimately familiar, but familiar enough with us, familiar enough with our story. But you're going to have some that a lot of this is probably jarring to hear, as not just Catholics per se, but also non-Catholics, but just jarring to hear these kinds of things being said. And I completely understand when talking about grooming how some people can literally not believe it. Not in a negative way, just it seems so. So if you wouldn't mind, when you speak to other people, is there any advice you can give to the listeners on just maybe some quick pointers on identifying grooming or ways to delineate between grooming and maybe just socially awkward behavior? Or what would you, have you ever had someone come ask you a question like that? If not, how would you answer that?
It's a difficult question to answer because grooming is so sneaky that it can be hard. It can mirror a good relationship. For example, a priest who is grooming their victim might try to seek alone time with them. They might even try to give them gifts of some sort. But you know, that could happen in a normal, my husband wanted alone time with me. He gave me gifts, you know, but it's totally different. So, I mean, I think with whether it's a Catholic priest or anyone, I think you just really need to be on your guard, especially if any kind of touch takes place. For me personally, there was a lot of talk that went on, but then the touch started very gradually. It starts with a hand on the shoulder, a hand on the back, a tiny hug. It's like you need to be aware of what your own boundaries are. And if you don't want to be touched at all, not even a handshake, I tend to have very strict boundaries. Even with priests I'm very close with, I generally don't do hugs. Maybe a high five, a fist bump. But beyond that, it's like I'm very careful, especially if I'm going to be alone with an individual. So something I do warn people about is just be especially mindful of the touch factor. Grooming is just really, really hard to spot because, again, it can mirror a perfectly good, normal, healthy, even holy relationship. And that's what makes this all clerical abuse all the more just evil, all the more horrifying to deal with.
And, you know, it's that's a good point you bring up, and I think that's something that everyone needs to be aware of. In our case in particular, Guidry didn't do Father Guidry, and for those who don't know, I still call him Father Guidry because he hasn't been laicized by the Diocese of Lafayette, so he's still a priest. His touching was very jokeful, so he would give you a punch in the stomach when you'd walk in, right? He'd you know, and that seemed like typical like guy behavior, right? Like your uncle will punch you in the stomach or something, right? And then the other thing, which, you know, of course is all retrospectively, mind you, but was helping us tie our robes for altar serving, even though you were doing it because we were smart enough to tie a knot in a rope. But so that's a very good point that you bring up because that's just an erosion of boundaries, right? You can fake punch us in the tummy. Well, then now we can do, I'll help you with your ropes. Well, now I can blah, blah, blah. You know, it keeps on, it's a snowball, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's a very good point to bring up. And also the fact that, you know, I find that too with the touching. I don't like that as well after everything. And it took like, it's so weird because it isn't, it seems so intuitive, but no one has the right to just touch you. So, I mean, are your children, right? So if you don't want someone, my wife and I have that problem all the time in Walmart. Little old ladies want to put their hands on the baby. No, you have no right to touch anyone. You have no right, you know. So setting those hard boundaries and not being scared that it might seem a little mean because it might be someone nice.
Yeah. I've had to a few times, and I tend to be very, hi, how are you? You know, I'm not the kind of person who generally is strict with other people and saying exactly what I want to say to them.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm thinking it, but I'm kind of like, I just tend to be awkward like that. But there have been times when absolutely I have, you know, when I've been pregnant, for example, and some random person just comes and they decide to touch your belly, like, whoa, yeah. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, I think the boundaries, the physical boundaries, when you start to really notice that, that's when I think you really need to be able to kind of think to yourself, okay, is there more going on here than just, you know, say spiritual advice? The other thing I would say, if you're someone who's, you know, let's say you want to seek out spiritual advice from a priest, but you're not sure how to go about it and you're afraid of, you know, no one said you have to be alone, or you can do it in a place where there are other people, say from a distance. For example, there are certain, if I want to go to confession, I will not go to certain confessions where, where the confessional is set up so that you can just kind of walk around the corner and sit in front of the priest. I refuse to go. I will only go where there is we are totally separate. Otherwise I just feel way too vulnerable. And that's even with priests who I truly, you know, love and respect. I just, for my own sanity, just putting up that boundary. I actually, at this point, I don't think they should even have face-to-face confession as an option. I think it should all be
I think if you want face-to-face, you should have to make make an appointment separately. But that's just my own opinion.
I think it's also important that last podcast I spoke about how those confessionals were invented to specifically prevent abuse. That mm-hmm. is why they were created, because of the issues that was present with face-to-face, and particularly the dangers that that provided, the dangers to both women and children that gave. So I think that's, we had just spoken about that last podcast.
Right. I remember having several phone calls from mamas who said their sons had gone to confession, and it was in the type of confessional where the priest could call the child over, and some things had definitely gone on, and the child would only mention certain things to the mother, so she had to fill in the blanks, and she's like, I really don't know what happened to my son. And she said this was, you know, several years ago, but she said the priest would call him around the screen. And she said, I had no idea that was going on in the confessional. So I think it's important for mamas to realize if you shut your child in that confessional, son or daughter, and that priest can call them around the screen, you have no idea if they have or have not done that to your child.
And let's normalize that it's not rude to say, I don't want my child going to confession, or I won't go to confession like that. Normalize that. That is not rude. That is not mean. You're not being difficult. And if you get a negative response to that, that's on them. That's not on you. that's their own problem.
After everything that the Catholic Church has been through with clerical abuse, I think there should, especially among priests, there should be a complete understanding.
Absolutely.
Of that. There should be. If there's not, I have questions.
Yes.
So Faith, how has, so obviously this has been very difficult with your faith. How has your faith played a role in the healing process, and how can faith communities better support survivors?
I have to attribute, it all comes back to my parents, because I probably would have given up my faith if it weren't for them. I saw their example that they set, especially, you know, having just lost a son. I watched them grieve, and then I watched as they tried to deal with what had happened to their daughter. And I was always moved by just their ability to keep going and to persevere in the faith no matter what. And I knew they were struggling. And I think that was something they passed on to me. Without my family, I really think I probably would have left the faith, because there were so many times when I wanted to. And I mean, there were supportive individuals in my life, good holy priests who, you know, also helped to kind of guide me and, you know, show me that all priests weren't bad, to remind me that it was the human part that had failed.
I was going to say, you know, we know that many survivors have left the church. How do you view them leaving the church? I know so many people think, well, they're just, you know, they just didn't have enough faith. You know, they didn't believe in the Eucharist. But for me, I look at them so much differently, even if I don't even know if they've been abused or if they are survivors of clerical sexual abuse. When I hear of somebody that has left, especially somebody who's, you know, even a little bit older, my age, older, in their 30s, 40s, 50s, the first thing I think of is, could they have been a victim? And I think there needs to be more compassion, because you talked about how difficult it was to go back into the church. We had so much trouble just going back into any church. Certain things, certain prayers that were prayed, certain times of the year when the priest came out with their blue pinwheels, you know, in support of sex abuse awareness for children or whatever, those were very difficult. How do you think we can teach our Catholic community to act differently towards people who've left the church?
I think it comes down to compassion, and not throwing the faith card out there like people who have done to me, and I see it done to victims all the time. You don't truly love Jesus, and how could you leave because of one Judas? I hate that expression. On the one hand, I get it, I do, but don't throw that in their face. It's like, come on. And honestly, you know, there was a time, I think a long time ago, when I felt like, well, if I can hang in there, how come they can't? But then over the years, I started to realize No, it just so happens that I had the right support. I had my parents behind me, and then, you know, eventually a good husband. But not everyone has that. And just having no, I know what it's like to feel physically ill when you're trying to walk into a church and you feel like I can't even go in. And then when, you know, especially for victims who have not seen justice done, and they see their predator running around, or they see what's been done with, you know, other cases that have just sort of been, you know, allowed to slide. You know, as much as it sounds so easy to say, well, don't leave because of that one Judas, it's a lot, you know, easier said than done. And I think that communities need to be far more compassionate. I think that people need to be more aware about grooming, you know, communities need to educate themselves. There need to be more, I think, public prayers for victims. One of the things that actually moved me the most in my entire healing journey of the last 20 something years was about a year or two ago. And Cardinal Sean O'Malley here in Boston had asked all priests to, on a particular weekend, to mention the crisis. Our pastor, he happens to be a dear friend of ours. He's one of our sons. He's his godfather. For his homily, he said, you know, I was asked to speak about this. He said, it's evil. It's terrible. I wish I could do more about it. And I know that there's not a whole lot I can do like myself. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to lead, you know, the congregation in prayer. And so he knelt down in front of the altar and he led the church in a rosary for his homily. To me, I lost it. It was because it was one of the first times I had seen a priest express sympathy in the only way that he knew how. That was compassion in that moment, because he didn't know what else he could do except, let's just pray for all survivors. Let's pray for change in the church. Those are the things that I think more Catholics need to be participating in. And don't be so quick to judge. Show some compassion and stop being so judgmental towards victims. Even if you're a victim yourself, be careful about judging other victims as if, like, oh, they're all going to behave the same way that you are. The way
and have
I
the same experiences.
Exactly.
So, Faith, before we end this podcast, we are so excited that you are actually on our board for Tent Makers of Louisiana. I feel like you have so much to offer in helping us to speak about clergy sex abuse, not only, you know, for the victim, the child victims, not only for the, you know, men, but also the women who have been victimized by priests. And you've joined Tent Makers to contribute to the broader conversation on breaking the stigmas and supporting survivors. Can you speak a little bit about, you know, why you agreed to join Tent Makers and what do you see moving forward and with what you can do to help us to move forward?
Well, I really, you know, I am just honored that you asked me to be a part of the Tent Makers, because it had become just near and dear to my heart, especially because I think people need an option to turn to other than the church. When you've been wounded as much as, you know, a victim of clerical abuse has, the last thing a lot of people want to do is go talk to, you know, another priest, or they don't want to go talk to the archdiocese. They just need support from someone who's been there, someone who's not necessarily affiliated with the Catholic Church. And so I think that's where the Tent Makers really comes in handy. I love this response team that we're working on building, because I think that is going to be a huge asset to not just the Catholic Church, but to other churches, other communities, because we know sexual abuse goes on everywhere. So to have those real life examples of not only, you know, talking to survivors, talking to people who know what they're doing, people who really know about the grooming process and everything that goes along with sexual abuse, that is going to be a huge asset to so many people.
So Faith, that was your big contribution that came out of one of our board meetings in the last couple of months, was the response team. Can you just speak a little bit about how we talked about that? And, you know, it is a big undertaking that we are working on. So if you could just expand a little bit on what we mean by a response team.
So the idea is to have a group of learned individuals, such as maybe survivors, detective, you know, sexual assault detectives, maybe even a nurse, maybe a parent of a survivor or a sibling of a survivor, people who are, you know, who have kind of been there or who just really understand sexual abuse, have a team go into, whether it's a school or a church, or, you know, pretty much anywhere, to explain the grooming process, to explain, you know, even as far as, okay, well, what's going to happen if it, let's say you've had a situation in a church where it's been discovered that a priest has been sexual abusing children. The response team could come in and just explain, okay, here's what's happened. Here's what sexual abuse is. This is what the grooming process is all about. Here's what to expect going forward. Here's some legal resources. Here's some, you know, even medical resources if you need them, and just really provide people with the information and the resources that they need to get through that, that situation, because it's not just the victims. It's also their families. It's the entire community that is hurt in situations like that.
Faith, thank you so much for joining us today, telling us your story. Thank you for everything you've said on the abuse crisis as a whole and the tips you've given to our listeners. Hopefully that will resonate with them, help them develop more empathy, compassion, and maybe even influence them to get involved, especially those who are able to. As we bring this impactful episode of Resilience in the Shadows to a close, our sincere gratitude goes to Faith Hakesley for bravely sharing her story and insights. We hope Faith's resilience and commitment to breaking stigmas surrounding clerical sex abuse leaves an enduring impression, reminding us of the strength that can emerge from the shadows. We trust that this conversation has shed light on the challenges faced by women survivors of sexual abuse and the importance of fostering understanding, empathy, and support. Faith's experiences emphasize the need to challenge stigmas, promote healing, and create a more compassionate world. To our cherished listeners, your presence on this journey is invaluable. If today's episode has resonated with you and you wish to support the vital work done by Tentmakers of Louisiana, consider visiting our website, www.tentmakers.la. You'll find resources, information on upcoming initiatives, and ways to contribute to the cause there. Your support relies on ensuring the continuity of podcasts like Resilience in the Shadows. By donating to Tentmakers through the website, you become an integral part of the effort to transform darkness into light. Every contribution helps us to bring more stories like Faith's, insights, and conversations that foster hope, healing, and justice. Thank you once again for being part of this transformative experience. For those intrigued by Faith's story and wanting to explore further, her book, Glimmers of Grace, Moments of Peace and Healing Following Sexual Abuse, is available. You can find it through various platforms, including Amazon. She also has a website mentioned in the introduction. Join us in our ongoing journey, and until next time, take care, stay resilient, and consider being the light in someone's shadows. Together, we can make a difference.